First of all, thank you for having me here. I used to be a postdoc here at ITP 15 years ago. I still have this hat, which doesn't have a K on it, right? It used to be an ITP. So I keep, you know, whenever I show up here again, which is always fun, I try to bring this hat, and otherwise it's in my house, and I don't wear it. It's a souvenir. Anyway, so this talk today, what I'll try to do is actually give three talks, three about 20-minute long talks, and we'll see how that goes, and maybe we'll don't get to the very end of it. But the idea is we'll start with a sort of short introduction of what it is that my group does. Then I'm going to go into my usual rant about philosophy and all that, and many of you in the room have heard it a few times. Some of you haven't, and so I would be happy to hear feedback. And then after that, we'll try to talk about nociception, which is pain, transduction, and warmth, and sense elegance. And we'll do it in two different ways. First way, we're just going to do the statistics of it and try to see what we can learn from statistics of behavior, if we can answer any interesting questions without actually doing the neuroscience on this form. And the second, we'll try to build dynamical models of this nociceptive escape behavior. Right? So it's basically three talks. So let's start with what it is that my group does. And I'm still here for the next 3 days. So if you have any questions, if you want any elaborations, I'm happy to provide those. But basically what we do is we study how biology processes information and learns, right? And mathematics is the same whether you study neurons, whether you study individual cells, whether you study populations, and evolving populations still processes information about the outside world and accumulate it in its own genomes, right? And so what I'm interested in is in trying to figure out what are the limits to this information processing, what are the computational and biophysical mechanisms that are involved in getting information out of the outside world and into something actionable inside you. And there are some examples of what we do. So for example, this is a terminal end bud of a growing mammary duct in a mouse, a mammary gland. And so in this particular system, once during is a during pregnancy or during development, there is an EGF gradient that is secreted, and the mammary ducts grow and branch in direction of the epidermal growth factor gradient. And so the question is, to which accuracy can they sense the direction in which they have to go? And we did a lot of modeling theory on this experiment, on this system, one experiment done by Andrei Levchenko, and what we realized is that this system is actually a relay channel where sensing is collective. All of the cells actually talk to each other, exchange messengers, and collectively make a decision of which way to go, and this is what allows them to sense gradients as small as about one molecule per 10 micron cell lengths in a time which is smaller than the typical correlation time for the exchange of these molecules. It's a collective decision making. We study things like immune signaling, inflammatory signaling, just trying to understand what are the limits on sensory transduction. You know, if we say that this is an information processing system, can we actually quantify it with the same notions as an engineer would quantify an information processing system? What is a bit rate? How many bits are pushed through the system? Where do they get lost if you transmit fewer bits than you thought you would, and so on and so forth. And so this is an F kappa B. This is if you cut yourself and the thing turns pink, there is some inflammation, that's an F kappa B doing that. And so we try to focus on this question. Going on from single input, single outputs, we study things like if you have a cell with, it never has a single receptor on it, right? Cells have, you know, E. coli has many, many different types of receptors. It senses many different types of molecules. Is there anything in this collective sensory system where you have multiple inputs and multiple outputs all resulting in the output single behavior? So can we say something about the accuracy of transmission of information in such a system where it's not one transmitter and one receiver? And interestingly, even engineers nowadays still do not know how to quantify systems with multiple inputs and multiple outputs correctly. Right? So we do not develop, you know, ad hoc networks are not the best nowadays still, right? In neurobiology, and this was sort of mostly systems biology, we study signal transduction, again, learning information transmission, multiple nervous systems. This is a fly, and one can ask, what is the neural code that this fly uses to transmit information from the eyes to the rest of the brain? And there is a series of papers by my advisor and his collaborators in the 90s, and then sort of the, one of the last papers was our work showing that the temporal accuracy precision of this neural code is down to about 200 microseconds. So if you move a single spike by just a bit, by just a few hundred microseconds, this means a different message, right? And recently we picked up these similar questions in the context of motor control, not in the sensory systems, but in the motor systems. And we have shown that, for example, in the bird, when this bird breathes, when this bird sings, it controls its motor output by multi-spike, not even a single spike, but three, four, two spike patterns, which are very precisely timed down to an accuracy of about 1 or 2 milliseconds. And if you move a single spike in that pattern by just 1 or 2 milliseconds, you will get either a different pitch or you will get a different structure of the breathing cycle in this bird. And this now, because it's a motor system and because we work with good experimentalists, is not just a correlative observation, it's a causal observation, because we can later go into this bird and activate those muscles with those specific spike patterns that we have identified as the ones that carry information, and we can see that the birds respond in exactly the same way as we do think that they would. And so you move a single spike in a multi-spike pattern by a millisecond and it sings a different note. Right? And so further going to sort of higher level functions learning, we study things like as conditional associations in the worm. A simple worm with 302 neurons is able to associate temperature and food, and frankly, the structure of associations is much more complex than people have thought previously. And so the question is, if you put it in a certain environment where there are foods and temperatures, gradients of temperature, gradients of food, how quickly does this memory emerge? How quickly does it dissipate? Is there a single type of memory, or there are multiple preferences that this worm experiences? Are there multiple dynamical variables? And so these are the types of data that we get, sort of the strengths of the association, and then the models that we build, and that's going to come out pretty soon. And looking at the same bird that I showed you before, see, this bird has headphones on it, right? And so these headphones are used to, there is a microphone also, and so when the bird sings, and it's very important for the bird to sing at the right pitch, because whether he gets an attention of a female or not depends on whether it sings the right song. And so when he sings, we listen to what it is it's singing, and then we lower or raise the pitch of what it is actually singing and play it back to the bird. So if he sings that he is singing too high or too low and tries to compensate for it, and we can try to understand, to model the dynamics of compensation in this particular system. And this is coming out literally tomorrow in PNAS. So this is experimental data and the fits of our model, and we can make predictions, and it turns out that the standard models based on reinforcement learning probably don't work in this system. You need to do something more interesting. So why do we study all of these things? And this is, you will see in the rest of my talk, I like good quotes. I have too many maybe good quotes in my talks. And at some point, a very dear friend of mine told me that I should have, I reached the age where I should have not quotes from others, but rather make my own quotes so that others cite me. And so I was thinking, usually in this slide, why do we study all of this thing? I have this quote from Immanuel Kant about the infinite depths of the starry skies and the infinite depths of your moral thought, etc., etc. But in reality, the reason why we do this is somewhat different. So on September 10th of 2001, when I was coming in as a postdoc here at ITP, a new young postdoc comes into the institute. You have to introduce yourself to the great director, David Gross, right? And so I entered David's office, and the first thing that he asked me, oh, a biologist, couldn't you find anything more exciting to do? And that was my response, right? That studying string theory cannot be more exciting than studying brains that can study string theory. And this is really the reason why back in 2001 and still now today in 2018 we do all of the systems, is because really trying to understand how we think, how the thought emerges in our head. This to me is one of the most interesting things one can study. Okay, so with that, this is an introduction. This is what we do, and now I want to start to switch to one of the three parts of my talk, and this is going to be the philosophy part. What do we mean by modeling behavior in this specific context? How should we model behavior on which level? And then we actually go through two different types of models. So the work was done with four different people. Brian Daniels used to be a postdoc in the group. He's now a faculty at Arizona State. Will Rue is an experimentalist in Toronto. He does all of this warm work. And then there are two graduate students. George was working with me at Emory. He is now somewhere in some data science company in Boston. And Alia Mohammadi did the experiments in Toronto. She's also in some data science company, but in Toronto. So, happens, right? So let's start with the following thing. And again, remember, this is philosophy, right? How do we improve and model this type of data, which I'll later show you we have. So the QBio, quantitative biology, has been around for about 20 years now, right? And there have been a lot of successes. It's probably true that when we all started 20 years ago, we didn't anticipate that the successes would be so big. So we know that, to me, what the successes are, that we know that circuits, be those neural circuits, molecular circuits, genetic circuits, can actually be modeled mathematically. There is no mysterious life force, right? You just put in enough differential equations and you put in enough statistical mechanics and you can actually do it, right? There is a model underlying all of those things. Even things like noise and variability, the usual story of noise in biology, that no two experiments are alike, if you really care about this, you can go and model the noise and variability and understand why two animals are different from each other, why two organisms behave differently from each other. We don't do it that often, but we can do it. We understand why the circuits are the way that they are. There are various information theoretic principles, there are optimization principles, control principles, and so on and so forth, and at least for small circuits, you know, ballpark dozen neurons, dozen genes, we can understand that there is no better way of building them, or maybe just a few other ways of building what we have that would achieve the goal that we would like to achieve. And then there are usual debates where you have maybe Reichardt correlator or some other model, and then for the next 20 years we're trying to figure out which of these only two models that could exist, that could solve this problem, actually are implemented in a particular animal, and maybe in some sense forgetting that the most interesting part is that there's only two models that could solve the problem correctly, and it turns out that at least one, you know, either one or the other actually is implemented, which is, I think, more interesting than which one of the two actually is implemented, right? So, but the interesting part is that, at least the way that I look at it now, there is no paradigm change in this biology. So if you go back to Kuhnian paradigm change science, right, we haven't discovered that much new physics yet, and I don't think we will in this sort of quest for quantitative biology. We understand that if I just take the usual non-equilibrium stat mech, if I get nonlinear dynamics and I put all of them together and I just add another couple of terms into my equations and I put it on a big computer, I'll solve it, right? There is nothing there in this systems that, at least for small circuits, right, for circuits of 10 genes or 10 molecules or 10 neurons, there is nothing there that we expect we will just never be able to solve, right?
Isn't that just like saying chemistry is just quantum mechanics?
Yes and no.
In principle,
I think the biggest point is what I'm trying to say next is that, chemistry of a single hydrogen is just quantum mechanics, but if you try to do a complicated molecule, then at that point more is different. And that's the part which we're also forgetting here, right? Is that, 10 neurons are not an organism, right? We cannot just build an organism by putting neurons together and understanding what it's going to do once you go from 1 to 10 to 1,000 to 10,000. And the most interesting part to me of this whole field is that it's infinitely easier to measure thousands of things in an organism nowadays than to understand what to do with those thousand things, right? The best thing that we know how to do are just to put them in a yet bigger simulation, in a yet bigger model, and then keep on for a couple of years playing with parameters and with wiring and so on and so forth, and trying to see if it can explain one or two experiments, right? And I don't think this is the best way of going forward. And so we sort of know, at least those of us who are coming from physics, we sort of know this more is different maxim, right? That we should at some point stop doing what has worked on one or two for three genes, et cetera, and do something else, but we don't know what else to do. And so if you believe that, for example, just putting molecules together, you will eventually get a worm, this is the type of experimental data that we will start looking at in this work. I don't know how to model this type of behavior. This is a crawling worm, C. elegans, 302 neurons, about 1,000 cells. The green light is the tracking of this worm, so it's a tracking laser, so we know where the head is. Every time green turns red, it means that we just shot an infrared laser into the worm. Temperature is rising very quickly. Worm doesn't like it. It's effectively pain. We know that this is not the same as a thermotactic response. If you knock out thermotactic neurons, it will still sense the high rapid change of temperature in the system, and it recoils, right? You hit it, and it goes back. You hit it, and it goes back. And yes, there are these websites, Open Worm and so on and so forth, where people try to model this worm with an accuracy of individual RNA is expressed in individual cells and modeling individual muscle fibers and the swarm and so on and so forth. But I bet you it's never going to work out that we will be able to model even behavior that is as simple as this one if we just keep on adding neurons and keep on adding muscles into a larger and larger sort of artificial neural network-based world, right? So this is one of the quotes which I like, which I think illustrates sort of this difficulty of going from genes and molecules and basic components, mechanical parts of the system, to an organism. And this is from Art Lander from Irvine, and so it goes as, "Culture's icon are a window into its soul. You would disagree that in the culture of molecular biology that dominated much of life sciences since the last third of the 20th century, the dominant icon was a double helix. In the present postmodern systems biology era, however, it's arguably the hairball." Right? And so this is in fact what's happening with essentially all of the QBio enterprise, is that we, as soon as we go from the regime of 10 units into a regime of where we hope to be able to understand them, to a regime of 100 units or more, it becomes this, right? And I'm allowed to show this picture. It's from one of my own papers, so nobody can tell me that I'm disparaging somebody else, right? And looking at this, I have no idea that this is actually an immune cell. This is a B cell. This is a response of a B cell to just emerging lymphatic cancers. I don't know how this emerges from all of this picture. It's just a hairball, right? So how do we go from molecules and genes to functional behavior? That, to me, is a question that we don't know how to answer, and frankly, nobody else knows how to answer for anything but an E. coli, maybe. So here is another beautiful quote, which I usually put as my first slide. Today, I decided to put it a bit towards the middle. This is a short story by Borges. And the reason why I really like this is that the title is actually Borges's title, right? It's not my title, it's what Borges called his story. On exactitude in science. "In that empire, the craft of cartography attained such perfection that the map of a single province covered the space of an entire city, and the map of the empire itself of an entire province. In the course of time, these extensive maps were found somehow wanting, and so the College of Cartographers evolved a map of the empire that was of the same scale as the empire and coincided with it point for point. Less attentive to the study of geography, cartography, succeeding generations came to judge a map of such magnitude cumbersome, and not without irreverence, they abandoned it to the rigors of sun and rain. In the western deserts, tattered fragments of the map are still to be found, sheltering an occasional beast or beggar, and in the whole nation, no other relic is left of the discipline of geography." And I think that basically what's happening to us in this field of let's measure everything and put it into a big model is that we're building a map on a scale of 1 to 1, which is never a good idea, right? Even humanists tell us that this is not a good idea. Right? So at the Computational Neuroscience meeting a couple of years back that we organized in Atlanta, this idea of putting things together into yet bigger and bigger model was everywhere. Right? In the presidium, one of the big open talks, people were arguing what is going to be the role of theory in biology, and the conclusion, the overall conclusion that everybody voted on was that the final theory in biology, biological systems, will be a large multi-scale computational model, and what we need to do is we need to go and measure and measure and measure more details of the system and put them into this large-scale multi-scale model. And there is something wrong with this, right? There are so many things wrong with the statement that I don't really know where to start, right? First of all, what is the final theory of an organism? Do we need a theory of everything? And again, I understand that there is a lot of people here trying to start to, in this building, working on a theory of everything, but nonetheless, do we actually need a theory of everything that explains everything in either biological or physical system, right? So an example of this, I mean, what is the theory of this coffee mug, right? I would argue that we sort of understand this coffee mug pretty well, right? We can make them, I know what's going to happen if I drop it, I know, it's going to crack it, all of those things, I know what this coffee mug does. And yet, there is not a single theory that actually answers all of these questions at the same time, right? If you want to understand how it's going to fall, you need to know Newtonian gravity. If you know and want to understand how it's going to crack, maybe you need to know something about glassy materials. If you want to figure out if I tilt it, what's going to happen to the coffee inside, that's, Navier Stokes, right? But not a single one of the theories is actually able to answer every question about the mug, right? You build theories by throwing away details and by identifying a specific set of questions that you want this series to answer, right? And that's the part which I think we're missing in biology, is that that theories must lose lose details, otherwise they become, sort of, in the yet another quote from Binder and Rosenbluth, the best model of a cat is another cat. You don't want to model a cat by a cat. You want a model which is simpler than the thing that you're modeling. Right? So that's going to be one of my last theory, my last philosophical slides before we go to real science. At Emory, we have this interesting program where we keep on going to India and teaching physics to Buddhist monks. This is, you know, some arrangement that Dalai Lama has arranged with our president, previous president of the university. And I keep on going there, teaching quantum mechanics, classical mechanics, and I realize that it's extremely easy to teach quantum, for example, to Buddhists because they don't know classical, right? So some both Newton and Schrödinger are exactly equally mysterious, right? There is no difference between the two. But there is one thing which makes it absolutely extremely hard to teach science to a typical monk in a typical monastery in a Buddhist monastery in India. And that's this idea which has sort of percolated through the Western scientific tradition, right? That there is a law, and there is the important law, and then everything else is the detail. It used to be the God's law, then it became the law of nature, and you know, a rock is obliged to fall under a certain you know, acceleration, be that in here at Santa Barbara or in my home in Atlanta or somewhere else, right? There is a law. And everything else is details, right? And we can add them later. And in this Buddhist tradition, there is something called the law of codependent origination, which tells you that, you know, every effect is a cause of its own cause, and every cause is an effect of its own effect. And there is no such thing as important causes, and there is no such thing as not important causes. Everything is interconnected, right? And so once you get to that point, you cannot do science. You don't know what's important, what's not, right? And I think that we are sort of like this train in one of these horror movies running into this wall where we suddenly will declare that there is no things that are important and things that are less important, and unless we put everything together and every single bit that we know about the system, unless we put it all together, it's not considered as an effective model or effective theory of a system, right? And so at that point, biology is not a science anymore. It's not a Western science anymore as we understand it, as we were taught in high school. Right? So what I will try to do in the rest of the talk is to look at one specific system, which is a sensory navigation system. We sense pain and we run away, right? So it sort of attaches to the title of this workshop. And I'll try to argue that one can build phenomenological models of the series which answer very specific questions and which are simple, right? Where you do not put in anything more than you need to, right? And we can even do it automatically, right? We can ask a computer to build such models for us without sort of scratching our heads too hard, right? And the important point there is that if you are studying behavior, maybe neurons are a wrong thing to study, right? Maybe it's behavior that you care about. Maybe you can predict, and maybe you can ask behavioral questions without asking, and what are the neurons doing, and you would be able to answer them without going to sort of this extra level and extra detail which are not necessary there. So, this is again the same picture, the same movie, which I'll show a few more times. So what are the type of questions that we can ask about this worm? And before I go there, any questions about, or comments rather, not questions, comments about philosophy that I've said, because I'm writing a bunch of articles for philosophy of science journals, and I want to hear if somebody has any complaints about what I've said. Yes, please.
I mean, I think clearly you can build a simple model to describe a simple behavior. Yeah. And you can say that's the essential thing. But the question I have is, you know, can you predict the effect of perturbations, you know, ablating a neuron or knocking out a gene or delivering a drug with a simple model that doesn't have the details?
So if your question is, what's going to happen if I ablate this particular neuron, then it better be the case that this neuron is in your model. Otherwise, the model isn't just the range of application of applicability of the model just doesn't include. If your question is what's going to happen to the worm, how it's going to depend tomorrow under the changes in temperature of the ambient whatever environment, then better be the case that the temperature is inside there, right? And so you can build models. They will have finite application ranges. You would hope that the model extrapolates, not just interpolates, right? If you train it for this particular perturbations, it can predict a few more, right? That would be the hope, and that's what I will try to show in our examples. But clearly, it's not going to go and answer questions about things which are not in the model, and that's okay, right? I mean, if I, you know, if I didn't put anything about the structure of a cap and I view it as a point particle, I cannot tell you when it's going to break when I drop it. Right? I can only tell you how quickly it's going to fall.
Did you try to come up with a simple example to convince the Buddhists that there's a causality in the notion of causality? What did you try?
Causality.
We
did the experiment. We went to the fifth floor of the whatever college. I mean, there's a Buddhist monasteries are not really monasteries; they're monastic universities, right? That's how they are built. Like they study, and the curriculum was last revised in 1600. So what they're trying to do is to revise curriculum now to include science and so on. Right? So we went to the top floor and we started throwing balls down, right? And some people were measuring the how long. And you can take a ping pong ball, you can take a tennis ball, you can get a cricket ball, right? We even found a bowling ball in India, which wasn't easy. Rocks, everything. And then you start throwing them and they all fall at the same speed, and then you start noticing that the tennis ball is a fraction of a second less than a cricket ball, right? And at that point you start sort of explaining that maybe the main effect here is gravity, and then the air is sort of a secondary effect that you can neglect if the densities are very, very different and so on and so forth. So we tried to do this, things like that, and I don't know how many people believed us, but that was the attempt.
Ilya, could you comment on this question of scale? Like, at what scale would you want to understand the system? So say if you have a behavior, right? Like, you could understand it from the point of view of just describing the behavior and trying to predict the position of the subject. Mm-hmm. Or, you could also try to include some generative models or some underlying process. But at what point can you be satisfied and stop?
I don't think there is a good answer to this question, right? You need to know what it is that you are trying to answer, and you build a model. You understand behavior with respect to that question, right? Again, coming back to the cup, what is a good model of this cup? If you only care how quickly it falls, then a point particle is good.
Cup, I don't understand because I don't care about a cup. But I mean, I care. Like, say, I want to reach and pick up my computer.
Yes.
Right? Like, how would I decide?
A car. At which point do you have a good enough model of a car? If you're only going to drive it, it's enough to know that if you push on a pedal, it accelerates, and if you turn a wheel, it goes right, goes left to right. If you're a mechanic, then maybe a different model is needed. You need to be able to understand how things actually are put together, right? If you're selling this car, then a very different model is needed to compare it to either two. And I think it's fundamentally you ask a question and then you build the smallest possible model that answers that question. And you work very, very hard to have nothing else in that model besides what absolutely has to be there.
So a counter argument to that is that say I'm trying to pick up my computer and there is an infinite number of models that could support, like in principle could support that. And I pick and there is one true one, right? There is like.
I don't think there's actually a true model.
I don't know. There is. I mean, I'm doing it.
I don't think that there is a true model. I mean, Newtonian gravity is not true, right? Einstein's relativity is not true. I don't even know what truth means in terms of science. But fine, there are some models that are better than others.
There is some biological process that we're trying to describe, presumably.
Yeah.
But the argument against picking the simplest model is that that might be the wrong model. So out of this infinite set of models, you might be constraining it to just the wrong set that's still infinitely large.
So why do you care if it's wrong if it makes all the right predictions, right? It walks like a duck, it quacks like
exactly,
a duck.
Exactly, right.
If every time you ask a question of the types of questions that you want to have answers to, the model gives you the right answer, then I don't see a reason why this is a bad model.
Yeah.
If there's one more question, I will move, right? It's fine, I mean, 45 minutes should be fine.
You actually kind of almost answered it. So I would say that how good the model is of course how well it can make predictions. And when you go around the world on a daily basis, you're making the models of the world And whether these models are true or not doesn't matter, as long as they can control your behavior in evolutionary sense. So as long as they can ultimately, you know, increase the frequency of your alleles, of your genes. And the reality behind the model doesn't matter. It's just the utility of the model.
I would agree with most of that.
Only by the, you know, in terms of organisms, by the evolution. So.
I would agree with most of that. Okay, so let me try to see, to describe what is a question that we're going to try to answer here. So first of all, I want to understand the system all the way from sensory to behavior, right? There's going to be some sensory signals, there's going to be some behavior, the warm recoils, and I want to understand how the two are related to each other. The questions are, can I predict what the worm is going to do once I give it a very simple stimulus, right? It's just a laser current. Just one-dimensional real valued stimulus, or can I pose this? What was the stimulus if the worm chose to do X? Right? So this is one type of questions. The maybe more interesting set of questions is the following. I mean, every time you go to a doctor, the doctor asks you, you know, do you feel pain on the scale of 1 to 10? Describe what that pain is, right? And it turns out that the scales are actually very quantitative. People actually repeat themselves all the time, right? There is not that much variability there. But if you're trying to develop a drug, an analgesic drug, you will probably start testing on animals. You cannot ask an animal, you know, what's your pain level? Has the pain level gone down after the drug has been applied, right? So how do I ask this question? What is your pain level and did it go down after I applied a drug from a behaving animal, right? That's another question. How do, you know, there is this joke that, you know, all of us growing up back in the Soviet Union, in physics, we heard about our biologist friends, right, that how do you prove that a cockroach listens with its legs, right? You clap and the cockroach runs away, then you tear away all of the legs and you clap and it doesn't. Therefore, it means that it doesn't hear you. Therefore, it means that it hears with its legs, right? So the usual story is when, you know, you take morphine and you are not allowed to drive a car, right? Why? Because it's not just pain reducer, it also changes your motor response and many, many other things in your system. So how do I distinguish parts of the behavior that are due to analgesic response versus parts of the behavior that are due to the perturbations to the motor system rather than to the sensory system? So these are all the types of questions that I would like to understand in this context of the worm. And so we'll start first with a statistical, maybe a bit physics-inspired model, and then we'll go to dynamical models of this. So that behavior which I've shown to you before, this is how you would quantify it. We only care about the velocity of the center of mass of the worm. The worm is going forward at about 20 pixels a second, give or take. And then you hit it with a laser. It very quickly reverses and goes down with the velocity. Goes back, negative means you're going backwards, with a speed up to about 60, 70 pixels. So it's about 3 body lengths a second or something like that. You know, 20 pixels is 1 body length here. And then the worm does it for a few seconds. It slows down. It does what's called an omega turn. Those worms crawl on their side, and so they bring their head towards their belly, cross over themselves, and then go in a different random direction, and then they emerge moving forward from that point again. So it's a typical trajectory. This is a trajectory after what we will call a paused state, where the worm has been hit, and instead of recoiling, it just slowed down and eventually started moving again. And this is an escape worm, where it's went back and then crossed over itself and went forward again. And this is a typical trajectory. This would be a trajectory of a worm that is moving forward. You hit it, it goes back, makes an omega turn and emerges in an opposite direction. A paused worm, you hit it here, it slows down and it keeps on moving in the same direction without making a turn, right? And we would like to build a model of, you know, at least a statistical model of all of these behaviors that would allow us to answer the question that I asked in the previous slide. So this is some dendrograms of how this worm behaves. If I hit it with a laser light of 10 milliamps, then this all happens at 1, right, at this point. The worm was going forward, then it pauses, then it reverses. It does an omega turn, which is green, and you have a lot of variability here as the signal strength becomes larger, you know, 60 milliamps, 150 milliamps. Behavior of the worm is nearly deterministic. They all go back, there is no pausing. They do an omega turn, they go forward. This is a lot more deterministic than this, clearly, right? So we'd like to understand this variability as well and try to see what the strengths of the laser are, you know, how does it affect the worm behavior. So the first thing that you could try to do, you could try to understand whether if what you want to do is to predict what was the laser current based on the behavior, so you want to postdict the signal based on the response, you will try to look at things like maximum velocity, maximum acceleration, you know, a few of these large-scale descriptors, and you will see that, you know, for example, as a strength of the laser current, you have, you know, the maximum reverse speed of the worm. They seem to be correlated, so there is something there. But in reality, if you try looking at the variability, this is just standard errors of the mean, right? The actual variability is huge, and so it turns out you cannot really make any reasonable predictions about what the laser current was if you just look at a few simple measures, like the maximum speed or the time when it made a turn or the time when it started going backwards. What you need to do is you need to look at the entire behavior of the worm, the entire time series, and that maybe that will have some information for you. So what we will do is we will simplify our analysis, just put a sort of cutoff here at 10 pixels per second. So this is maximum escape velocity. If the worm doesn't escape, or it doesn't escape fast, we're going to call it a paused worm. If it escapes at a maximum speed of more than 10 pixels, this is going to be called the active worm. And what we can try to look at is what is the probability that the worm actually is active rather than paused as a function of the laser light for three different types of worms that we're going to be dealing with in this experiment. One of them is the red one, control. It's right under there. It's an N2 strain. Another one is ibuprofen worm, which means an N2 worm which was previously drowned in ibuprofen solution. If you know worm biology, you would sort of question why we're doing this, because it doesn't have prostaglandin system, so ibuprofen has no way of working, and yet it does, right? So, and why, we have no idea. And then there is a mutant, there is a certain TRIP mutant that affects thermal sensation channels, and so this is viewed in this field as a mutant that reduces sensitivity to temperature signals, so it's effectively an analgesic mutant, right? And so indeed what you see are things that both the laser, the control and the ibuprofen mutant, the probability that they are in the paused state is almost one when the laser current is small, and it goes to zero when the laser current increases, so worms don't pause, they immediately escape. And for the mutant, for the ibuprofen mutant, this line is shifted, so this would mean that it seems that the worm is indeed sensing pain less, right? Because it's just pausing, even at much higher laser currents, and doesn't escape even at much higher laser currents. Is this correct? So we'll get to that point. So how are we going to model this? We're just going to do simple Bayesian modeling, where we'll say the probability of the having observed the velocity trace, probability of the current that was applied to this worm is given by the probability of observing this velocity given the current, times the probability of the current divided by probability of the velocities. This we control experimentally. This is just normalization. So the only thing that we need to do is we need to measure what is the probability of showing a specific velocity given the worm is hit with a certain current, right? And so what we will say is that there are two states to the worm, Y2, because it seems to work enough. So the one state is a paused state, one state is an active state, and so probability of observing a certain velocity is the probability of observing this velocity given that you are in the paused state, times the probability of being paused, plus the probability of observing the velocity given that you are in the active state, times the probability of being in the active state, and we're going to model probability of being in the active state as this Hill function. Why we choose it is because since it fits with a Hill function, they seem to fit the experimental data quite well. Okay. And so having done that, we can now go to an experiment, and we can say what we need to measure now is what the probability of velocity of a certain escape velocity trace, the whole V over T, for an active state given a certain I. And we'll say that this is a multivariate Gaussian. All the tests say that it's okay to model it as a multivariate Gaussian. But what we will do is the following. We'll say that this is a multivariate Gaussian, but of a very certain specific shape, right? When you experience pain, if you are, let's say, hit, you have just immediate risk escape, right? Your arm is going to move away very quickly. And the stronger the pain is, the faster the arm is going to move away. there is some kind of a stereotypical response which is modulated, the amplitude of which is modulated by the strengths of the pain that you're experiencing. And so we're going to do the same. We're going to say that the velocity is Gaussian distributed around some kind of a stereotypical escape template, and then this template is multiplied by a scale factor which only depends on the laser current. Okay. This is going to be our template, right? So it's again a Hill style or Michaelis style function with an offset, so that if you escape, you escape with a minimum escape, whatever velocity. But at that point, it's non-linearly increasing after that once you add additional stronger perturbations. So this is for the active state. We will do the same for the post state, except that in the post state there is no escape, so we're not going to have any scaling. And you're just Gaussian around essentially zero velocity. So how does scaling work? So these are the means and the error bars of velocities with this particular currents. The bands as the colored bands as the error bars. And so if I say that I'm going to believe that all of my escapes are stereotypical, so I'm going to try to collapse them onto the same curve with just different scaling factors, I will get something that looks like this, right? So clearly, these curves are almost collapsed. They're much better closer to each other than this one. It's not a perfect collapse, but pretty close. And so it seems like modeling this as a stereotypical escape might not be such a bad idea, right? And so having done this, we can do things like this. We can calculate what are the templates for the post state, sort of the average velocity during the post state, which is actually not that interesting. But this part is interesting. This is an average velocity for the templated velocity for the active state. So if the worm is escaping, then it's escaping with this velocity profile times a scale factor, which is dependent only on the current. Right? And so the reason why this is interesting is that, first of all, you will see that the control and ibuprofen templates are nearly on top of each other. So if the worm escapes, right, whether it's an ibuprofen worm or a control worm, they are indistinguishable. It's just the amplitude may be different, but the actual template is the same. But the mutant is substantially different. So the actual way that the worm escapes under this strip mutation is a different template than the other two. It turns out the part which is not visible here, unfortunately, is it's also the case that the green is slightly delayed after the red and blue by about 1/16 of a second, right? So not only the template is different, the template is activated later, right? So I'm maybe trying to argue that this trip mutation is not just a sensory mutation. It does something to the motor program, not just to the amplitude with which the motor program gets activated. So maybe it's like morphine. It affects your sensory perception, but it also affects your motor abilities. So we can ask how good these models are. There's various ways of checking the quality of the model. Let's just look at this one over here. So we're plotting here effectively the R squared, 1 minus R squared of the model for all of the three different types of worms. And so this is a fraction of variance that could have been explained by the model, but is not, right? There is some animal-to-animal variability where say exactly the same conditions result in different escapes that we cannot explain with our model, so that's not modeled here. But of the explainable variance, how much of it wasn't explained? And you see that, again, the ibuprofen and the control worms will explain about 80% of the variance, right? 20% of explainable variance remains unexplained. But for the ibuprofen, the explanatory power is a factor of two worse, right? So the model seems to be, this templated escape model seems to be quite good for the red and the blue control and ibuprofen, but it's pretty bad for the mutant. Okay. And so I can ask now the following question, right? Coming back to my analgesic question in the beginning. So if I look at a worm and I put the worm into ibuprofen and I try to decode, what do you think is the laser power with which this worm has just been hit? But I will decode it using the control model, right? So I will believe that this is a control worm, but it's in fact an ibuprofen worm, and I will get what is the laser current that I think was applied to this worm under the control model, and I will compare it to the real laser power, right? And so if the worm under an ibuprofen action behaves as, you know, let's say you hit it with 100 milliamp current, and it behaves as if you just hit it with a 50 milliamp current, right? Then the function of this perturbation of this ibuprofen is to reduce the pain sensation by 50 milliamps. Right? You went from 100 to a 50, and that's in fact what we see. This is the actual applied current, and this is the decrease in the reconstructed current if I apply this control model to the behavior of an ibuprofen worm. And you see that ibuprofen has actually a very interesting analgesic effect, right? It is not analgesic at all at small currents, and then once you get to about 100 milliamps in these worms, it decreases the perceived pain in the worm from 100 milliamp level to only a 70 or 75 or 80 milliamp level. And that's pretty statistically significant. On the other hand, even though mutant is, you know, remember it, the scale of the fraction of mutants which were poison versus active was very, very different, right? If I try to do the same thing on a mutant, I get curves that look like this. There's a huge variability. I cannot even say that the mutant's perception of pain has changed dramatically or not. And the reason is because the model doesn't fit, right? So if I take my control model and I apply it to the mutant data, the model doesn't know what's going on because the worm is not behaving as if it's escaping with the same template as the control models where the control worms were escaping with. And so the answers that it gets once you start doing statistical analysis get huge error bars, right? Yes, there is some reduction in perception of pain, but it's not the only thing that goes on, right? Something else, the changes to the motor program of the worm are additionally happening, and they're convolved with the perception, the sensory perception, and that's why we cannot really say how strong the reduction of the sensory perception was. So the answer here is, I mean, the point here is that we never went to the neurons. The only thing that we did was we described the behavior, right, and measured the behavior and calculated all of this, basically built a model of behavior using templated response, which is what we expect for basic recoiling under pain, right? And we are able to answer these questions, like, for example, is this particular perturbation a sensory perturbation, or is this perturbation, does it do more than just sensory? Does it do also changes to the motor program or some other internal processing, right? We can measure how well these models do, and we can even give you this answer, you know, how much pain does the worm experience? I can reconstruct from the worm's behavior what is the equivalent laser current that the worm has been hit with, right, which is an equivalent of measuring your pain in units of laser current, right? So the worm, which is in laser current worm, hit with ibuprofen worm hit with 100 milliamps, experience pain at the 75 milliamps level. Right? Now I can ask this question without actually having to ask the worm. Right? And we, of course, can do it for larger animals, and that's what we're trying to do now in mice, you know, facial features in mice, how that happens and so on.
I think I have missed one really critical step in this argument, and you probably said it, but can you repeat why this observation that the motor output only changes in scale and not in shape demonstrates that whatever happens is not in the motor path, but rather in the perception path?
I'm not going to say that it completely demonstrates it, right? What I say is that it makes it more plausible that the perturbation is only a sensory perturbation, because the logic there is that there are sensory processing system, right? It outputs the value, you know, how painful the signal is, and the more painful the signal is, the faster you run away, right? And so if you keep on running in exactly the same way as you would have, like exactly the same pattern of running away, but just a small amplitude, it means that you're experiencing, or you could interpret it as if you are experiencing a smaller amount of pain. But if you're running away in a very different pattern, right, then it clearly is not the case that the only thing that has happened is that the sensing has changed.
So the argument is that under non-anesthetized situations, they scale their response with laser power, but they don't change the shape.
Right.
And then when you do apply the analgesic, they still do the same thing, but the scale is different.
But the scale is different, right? While for mutant, they don't do the same thing.
Right.
So if you've got an unknown mutant worm, and you ran it through this assay,
right,
how confident could you be that you could predict whether it was on the sensory side or the motor side or some neural modulator that just made them busy eating instead of likely to respond? How far can you push this about categorizing new things that you didn't put into the model to begin with?
I mean, first of all, we didn't know what the answers would be. Was ibuprofen always this, and tributant was supposed to be a pain mutant, right? This is what everybody uses in the field, right? Ibuprofen was supposed to have no effect at all, right? And it does, right? We also have the same data for morphine, really, and it's closer to this than to that. I think I'm not going to give you a sort of an exact answer because, like, clearly, if the error bars are this big, then the model works, right? If the error bars are this big, then the model doesn't quite work. But if the error bars are up to here, then it doesn't work at all, right? And at a certain point, you will need to make a cutoff and decide for yourself whether you believe that these error bars tell you that the worm is just doing the sensation or just doing the motor perturbation. I don't know how to quantify that.
Can I ask why, for the template, you used velocity as time, first time, instead of like eigenmode projection first time?
Did everything and just absolutely no difference statistically, and at that point, you just use the simplest thing.
Do you worry about threshold in this situation where, you know, up to a point, experiencing a certain amount of pain will not change your motor pattern, but it's only beyond the threshold that you would actually begin to see?
I think this is a great segue to the next part of my question, right? So we started with this question of we partitioned the worms into active and passive worms. Okay, why did we do this? Right, passive worm basically it experiences some temperature rise, but it doesn't escape, right? And then the active worms they do escape, right? So is it really the case that there are two or in fact three different states in the system that worm is either going forward or pausing or going backwards, right? Or how do I even know this, right? Should I be worried about the fact that it seems like there are discrete states which are engaged with different probabilities as a discrete states, right? So in order to answer this, I think that one needs a better model of the system where it's not just a model of just the statistics in some sense, but one needs to understand the underlying dynamics of the worm. And that's what I want to talk about in the next half. And maybe it's not the best segue, but I think it's a good question to start talking about that. And then if I don't answer this, you can ask me again.
My only worry is that if you're losing, the observations about motor pattern to quantify this, then there is a certain circularity that comes into it because you would need to, you wouldn't be able to infer any kind of thresholding, etc., just from the motor patterns. If any kind of non-linearity that comes into the at the perceptual level would not be apparent in the motor pattern.
That's probably true.
I just wanted to make a comment on, maybe you addressed this on the second part as you were suggesting. One of the beautiful aspects of this is that there is certain stereotype or stereotypic kind of movement.
Almost. Not quite, yeah.
Good enough, such yeah. that you can actually generate these templates, right, and compare them. I just was wondering, these are a specific sort of states of motor systems, right? So escape is one good example, saccade in insects, there are other good examples, but there is a larger space of movement that doesn't necessarily follow sort of a stereotype behavior. And I was just, maybe we can discuss this in coffee break, but...
No, ask in 10 slides, okay?
Okay, great, all right.
So the question is, can we now build a dynamical model of this, not just an escape in terms of three different states, but I want to understand the dynamics of the velocity v as a function of t just completely, right, over this whole 2 seconds of the escape. I want to be able to predict that. And so what we are going to do is, again, we're looking at this swarm. My question is, having observed this swarm, I really want to write down the differential equations that describe the dynamics of velocity as a function of time. And I want those differential equations be interpretable. I don't want it to be some weird neural networks that I have no idea what's going on inside. I want to be able to have every single term of these equations tell me something about the underlying system. Okay? So can we do something like that? And so what we're going to try to do is I'm going to sort of walk you through this method that we have developed over the last few years and then apply it to the biological, to the worm picture. But the idea is that we are trying to find equations that describe the system dynamics, so dx by dt is some function of all other x's. So in this case, x is the velocity, right? And I'd like to try to understand to find these equations. We're not going to fit curves, not actually the behavior v of t, but what I would like to do, I'd like to fit the right-hand sides of this dynamics. I want to understand what the forces are, not necessarily what the kinematics is. We're going to completely neglect stochasticity. We're going to completely neglect the spatial structure of this dynamics for now, and just look at the ordinary differential equations. And so the question is, how do we automatically feed this type of functions fi from data? How do we enumerate all possible sets of functions? How do we search through this very, very large set of all possible right-hand sides? How do we not overfit? And all sorts of questions of this type. Right? That works.
Since he seems to be approaching the problem in such generality, why is temporal locality so obvious? You know, there are some very simple differential delay equations that you can write down, which would be pretty difficult to approximate with a finite number of those.
I agree with you, and at the same time, I sort of disagree, because usually temporal delay means that there are, at least the way I look at it, that there is some other internal hidden dynamical variable, right?
Memory.
Sorry?
Memory.
Yeah, so there is an internal dynamical variable, which is where this memory is stored. And what I notice is that there are dots here. I didn't tell you how many equations there should be. So in principle, even if you have one-dimensional time series, you may need to have 25 differential equations to describe that time series. And we're going to do exactly that. So I don't want to introduce delays, but
I guess what I'm asking is, since you're building a phenomenological model,
right,
you probably want to have as few parameters as possible, and that you can write down sort of a first-order differential delay equation, right? Just introducing one delay parameter and expanding it in ODEs
could be hard.
Going to be pretty hard.
So I think that can we postpone this question for 2 minutes? Literally 2 minutes. Okay, I'll show you a few examples. Okay, so. We are, of course, not the first ones to try to do this. There is a series of papers all the way from 87 from Crutchfield, McNamara, and very recently there's even websites like automated statisticians where you provide your time series data and they will give you a model for this time series data and so on and so forth. One of the big questions, what Boris has pointed out, is that we want to build the simplest model in some sense, right? We want to have a model that doesn't overfit, because it's very easy to, if you're searching through all space of all possible differential equations, fitting the data is not going to be hard, right? And so how do we make sure that we don't overfit? And you know, if you did some basic statistics, you're trying to, let's say, fit curves through these data points, you can put a first order line, a second order line, a third order line, right? So fine, there is some kind of a polynomial here. Y is equal to ax plus bx squared plus cx cubed and so on and so forth. How do we choose which order of polynomial it is? And it turns out there are simple ways of doing this, right? You can use something called Bayesian model selection. It will tell you you're fitting well enough, but you're not overfitting if you, for example, have a second order polynomial here and so on and so forth. And this has been worked out long ago starting with Schwartz, and then Vijay Balasubramanian had some nice papers on that. And then 2005, I've actually proven that the same Bayesian model selection would work for an infinite nested family, meaning that even if you're choosing not just from 5 choices or 10 choices, but you're choosing from a countable infinity of possible models, and as long as those are nested, right? So each next model, you go from the first degree polynomial, second to third to fourth. Fourth degree polynomial includes all third degree polynomials inside it, plus something else, right? So as long as the models are nested, then the simple Bayesian model selection is going to do a job for you and make sure that you fit, that you choose a model which is strong enough to fit the data, but not too strong to overfit the state, right? That's what we're going to use, and I can explain what Bayesian model selection is later after the talk. The problem is that if we are dealing with this type of arbitrary dynamical systems, and I start with, let's say, time series x of t, the simplest model of this would be some kind of a linear model, dx by dt is ax, right? But then I can improve this model by adding either more hidden variables or adding more nonlinearities. So and each nonlinearity is an extra parameter, and each hidden variable is yet an extra parameter or more, right? So the delayed equations would be equivalent to some kind of hidden variables. And the problem is that at this type of set cannot be uniquely ordered, right? So the models of which can be expanded along two different directions, two-dimensional space is not uniquely orderable. And so in this case, you cannot build a nested hierarchy of models, or at least you cannot build a unique nested hierarchy of models, and therefore all of these Bayesian model selection things that have been so powerful in statistics won't work, right? And so what we took us a while, but what we've decided that we are going to do is we basically start with the simplest model, something that is linear and has exactly the same number of variables as the number of time series that you have, and then we expand it all the way to the most complex model, which has the most nonlinearities, all possible nonlinearities, and all possible, and has infinitely many equations and it coupled equations in it. But we expand it along a one-dimensional line, right? Meaning that I add certain type of nonlinearities. For every nonlinearity, I add so many hidden variables, and for every hidden variable, I add an extra nonlinearity. And if this hierarchy is chosen well, meaning it matches the real biological system, then you will not need to go far away along this line till you get a good model. If the hierarchy is chosen badly, then you will need to go very far, right? So maybe, for example, if your model has 25 variables and all of them are linearly coupled, and your hierarchy is that I'm first going to add nonlinearities and then add hidden variables, then you're screwed, right? It will take you a lot of time to get additional data and fit things in. And so what Boris's question was, if you have a system which is a delayed equation system, this is basically yet another choice of the nonlinearity or of this line in this large dimensional space where you're adding your hidden variables in a certain very specific way, right? And it may be that the choices of these basis functions of how we add nonlinearities to the system and hidden variables to the system explain biology well. It may be that they don't, right? And we will see once we start doing modeling, how much data do we need in order to produce a reasonable model of this experimental data. And it might be that our models work well, or it might be that something that Boris suggests works well. And clearly, I wouldn't be talking about the worms if what we say it does not work well, wouldn't work well here, right? It's basically a choice of basis functions. And sometimes, you know, choosing Fourier polynomials is better than choosing algebraic polynomials. Sometimes it's the other way around. And you may get lucky, or you may not. Right? And so I think that that's the answer that I would give to what you are asking. So there's two different hierarchies that we have investigated in detail. And so one of them is what's called sigmoidal recurrent networks, which is almost neural networks, not quite, right? Where you start with the known variables dx by dt, they linearly relax. They have interactions with each other, which are the weighted sums of sigmoids, basically Fermi functions of all other variables, plus linear weights of the inputs. And so when you grow these networks, you add an additional hidden variable. And as you add hidden variable, it needs to be coupled to every other variable in the system. And so you add an additional nonlinearities on top of adding additional variables. The beauty of this is that these are saturated functions, so you would expect that if the right-hand sides of your real dynamics do not have any infinities in them, then this might actually fit well, and you can prove that this way, there are beautiful representation theorems that tell you that eventually by adding reasonable number of variables, you will be able to approximate everything, except that this eventually may be very long if your right-hand sides have divergences. And another class of models that we played with is something which Mike Savageau introduced many years ago, which are called S-systems, which are generalizations of mass action kinetics. So dx by dt is A some other x times some other x, right? So it's a mass action kinetic with fractional powers. Those would be nice if your right-hand sides in real systems do have divergences, 1 over r squared or something like that. You would see how it is easy to get them done. Right? On the other hand, since power functions diverge somewhere, either at 0 or at infinity, if your right-hand sides in real systems, if your forces do not have divergences, this would not be a very good class of models to fit. Right? And then you could think of another class of models, which would be delayed equations or something like that that we haven't yet investigated, but clearly we could if we wanted to. And so just before we go to biology, so a couple of examples of what we've been able to do. So we took the system to our code, we supplied trajectories of about 200 planets moving around the sun. And then we asked, could you predict to us where a new planet that I'm releasing somewhere here is going to go? And so these are all out of sample testing. Moreover, it's not just out of sample, it's out of the sample range testing, right? We are putting planets which are much farther away from the sun than we have trained on, or much closer to the sun than we have trained on. And so what you see, the dotted lines is what these planets would do. The solid lines is what our predictions are, which is not bad, right? One sec, let me finish this, right? And over here, what I show is the phase portrait of the system. And of course, we know that the equations of motion are second order equations, right? So the phase portrait should be two dimensional, R and V. We never told our code that the equations of motion are two dimensional. We just gave it a time series R, right? And then it figured out that in order to model them, you need to introduce a hidden variable to the system, and so the phase portraits would be two-dimensional, and this is a true phase portrait, and this is a phase portrait that our system has learned, and you see that they are qualitatively very, very similar. There is some discrepancy here, which is not a big deal, because we never told our model that the hidden variable is velocity rather than, for example, velocity to the power of 1.5, right? And so the fact that the Morse smell complexes of both systems are the same is sufficient. They don't have to be exactly the same, right? So effectively, we have discovered that the equations of motion are two-dimensional equations of motions, and we have discovered that the phase portraits of 1 over r squared are what our model thinks they needs to be introduced in the right-hand sides to model the system. You had a question?
So you just mentioned that the model seems to be working out of the range of the training. I couldn't see anything in the method that would make it work for extrapolation, not only for interpolation. So how is it that it worked?
So I think that this is one of those cases where I don't impose that it has to work for extrapolated data. And the fact that it does means that we have discovered something truly correct in some sense about this model, that we stumble upon the right equations that turn out to do the right job, right?
Can you think of, this is connecting to the philosophy, can you think of methods that would guarantee some extrapolation ability?
Yes and no. I have 5 minutes left. I want to finish the talk, okay? And after that, we can talk about this. So we can also look at other examples that people have tried to do inference on. And this is glycolytic oscillations in yeast. So the type of data that we have in the system is actually very complex in some sense. So it's a seven-dimensional system. We said we're only going to observe three different variables in the system, only three, just randomly chosen. The datum for us is the initial concentration of these variables, and then a random time later, final concentration of these variables. There is a 10% additive noise. And then we give about 40 such observations, so input, gap, output, and we ask, can you infer the differential equations that describe this system? So what we do, this is our input, this is various tests, let's not pay attention to them, and this is the output, and again, the dotted line is predictions out of sample, what the system should be doing, and the solid line is our predictions, and the two match quite well, right? There's a couple of, this is only from 40 observations, the computing time is long, takes a week, but it's tolerable. The interesting part, which was worrisome to me, is that the system said that the equations of motion are six-dimensional. that it was able to fit all the data with six-dimensional equation of motion, not just on an attractor, but the approach to the attractor is the entire phase space, right? And the original equations are seven-dimensional. And so that was a problem, right? You know, you say that six dimensions are there, where in fact it was seven. And then we started digging through it and realized that there is a conservation law in the system, that the number of carbon atoms is conserved, right? And so in reality, the system is not seven-dimensional. It's a six-dimensional system just masquerading as a seven-dimensional system. And it was pretty interesting that the that our fits were able to discover what's going on there. Okay. This is all simulated data published a while back. So now I want to apply this to the worm. And this is a paper which we're supposed to put on the archive like last week. It's written. I can distribute the draft for comments if you want. So the interesting question there, and this is coming back to what I was saying before, is why do we say that the dynamics is sort of this multiple states, right? The forward, reverse, pause, et cetera, et cetera. There is another possibility, and it would be nice to answer whether this is correct, in fact, happening or not, where there's only one attractor in the system, and it's going forward, right, for example. But when you apply a current, the attractor itself moves, and the worm tries to chase its own attractor and starts going backward, and then the attractor returns to moving forward, and the worm starts moving forward, right? There is not really a separate backward state. There is just one behavioral state that the worm tries to chase. That's one possibility, or the other possibility that you have two different states and the worm just switches between them. In fact, maybe three, because there is a pause state somewhere in the middle. And so that was the question that we tried to answer. If I build a dynamical model, and then now I have my dynamical model, can I analyze it, and can I understand what is the actual phase diagram or the phase portrait of the system? So this is the trajectories of what the worm does, the real data. This is the fits of our model. I'll show you what the model is. Fits are not bad. This is a standard error of the means. In reality, the chi-squared per degree of freedom is below one. So we are, if anything, we're probably overfitting rather than underfitting. This is all trained using, you know, your favorite stochastic gradient descent methods. Otherwise, it would take forever to do. And so I can plot here, for example, how many parameters are there in the model as we add more and more and more data, and the model starts very simply, and then it starts adding extra features, extra parameters, and eventually it settles down to about 10 parameters. And at the same time, the chi-squared per degree of freedom decreases to below one, so we fitted the data, right? So fitting is not that hard, right? Can we actually, why we should believe this fits, right? And so believing this fits would be, before I go there, remember I showed you that for the curated model, statistical model we did before, the chi-squared the r-squared for the control worm was between 0.1 and 0.2, right, this red line. So we explained 80-some percent of explainable variance with that model of stereotypical response. Here we don't impose any stereotypy. We just learn the differential equation during the dynamics, and this is what happens, right? We are on average factor of two better in terms of R squared, right? We explain between 90 and 95% of explainable variance with this fully automated model, which computer ran for a week and spit it out a model for us, and I'll show you what the model is in a second. So the fits are very good, that's what I'm trying to say, and we don't need to impose the stereotypy to provide the fits, which are even better than what we spent a couple of years before trying to build by hand. This is how the phase portrait of the system looks like. So what you see is, first of all, the system has two dynamical variables, velocity and something else, some memory, right? There's a null clients, this is a fixed point, and worm is moving forward, zero memory and, you know, 15 velocity, and then when you hit it with a laser current, the fixed point jumps to negative velocity, and the worm tries to chase its own laser, its own fixed point. It starts going backwards, accelerates, and then because the laser, you know, the worm escapes the area where it was hit, the signal disappears, the fixed point goes back to forward motion, and the worm returns to it, right? So in fact, what this prediction tells us is that there is no multiple states. There is just one behavioral state, and this state itself is perturbed by the sensory signals, and the worm chases its own asymptotic state, right? So why we should believe this? So first of all, any data or any models are only useful to the extent that they make predictions. So let's try to make some predictions sort of out of sample, not interpolations, but predictions, extrapolations. We've trained this data only on the first 2 seconds of the escape. In the first 2 seconds of the escape, most of the worms are still going backwards. Okay? So they recoil and they are going backwards. And then 3 to 4 seconds later, they will stop and they will cross over and start going forward. Okay? So can we predict at which point will the worm's velocity hit zero, so that the worm stops and then after that it starts moving forward? And this happens at 3-4 seconds down into the future, so it was outside of our training range, and let's see how well our models make these predictions. And so here I plot the time to change to forward motion as a function of the laser intensity. This are individual worms. This is averages in bins. This is prediction of our model. And this is the same time to the forward change for the peak reverse speed. So how quickly was the worm moving backwards, and then how long it will take it to start moving forward again. And I emphasize that both of these plots are not fits, right? So I fitted the data to the first 2 seconds of motion, and then I'm asking, you know, what will happen 3 to 4 seconds into the future, and there's no pre-parameters here, and I would suggest that these are pretty darn good predictions, right? There is actually still happening. You can do statistics, and we have the second half of the points are on average larger, higher than the first half of the points. We pick this up correctly. They're also not linearly higher, right? So in the beginning of the curve, there is some saturation effects and so on and so forth. So in some, if, for example, the data was truly flat and our model was also saying that things are truly flat, this would also be a reasonable prediction. I think that the two of them together are good enough, right? And the point is that, again, that we are predicting twice into the future compared to what we have trained.
Since this is a model for a worm, there is potential...
For an average worm.
Well, but that's the question. I mean, you haven't been out of the model, so it could be a model for a worm. Does that then mean that if you have the worm is off the mean at one time, it's going to stay off the mean? There's a temporal correlation, worm by worm, that should be in the model.
So this is a model of a worm. We have now started doing a model of worms, meaning that we try to impose the same dynamical system with varying parameters, where parameters are only determined for individual worms, but the overall dynamics, overall set of equations are determined, are the same for all worms, it's only the parameters that change.
Could be noise of some sort or another, even if the model parameters are the same.
And my best answer at the moment is we're trying to do it right now. I have nothing to report. Right? So for now, we're just trying to build a model of an average worm. I'm wrapping up just two more slides, I think. So this is actually the model that we inferred. It's a very simple model V. There is some memory X. Memory is a linear integrator of the sensory stimulus, which is, in this case, H, the heat. And then it goes into the equations above, and this is a diagram of what actually happens, right? So you have a laser current. It's, if our model is correct, it means that it's measured by two different sensory systems. One of them is the backward, you know, sort of responsible for activating the backward drive. One of them is integrating the stimulus into some kind of memory, which suppresses the forward drive, and we know that there are type B interneurons which are involved in the forward drive in the worm, and they are suppressed by the sensory stimuli, by the sensory neurons, pain sensation neurons, AFD and FLP. So when you apply the current, the worm slows down, the backwards drive gets activated, the worm escapes. At some point, the backward drive is so large that it starts suppressing itself, the worm slows down and returns back to the forward velocity, right? And so effectively, all of these arrows that is sort of the interpretation of this dynamical system, they exist in the worm with an only possible extension, exception that we really don't know which neuron does the linear integration. Could be probably FLP neuron, not clear. We don't know that, right? This is the only part that you cannot really put biology on, which means that there is actually a very strong prediction right now that there has to be a neuron in the worm possibly FLP, maybe something else, which really what it does is a linear integration of the temperature stimulus that the worm has observed on a scale of about 1 second, right? 1 to 1.2 seconds. And so with that, what I want to end with is that what I've been arguing here for this second part, for the systematic inference at least part, is that we need to de-emphasize the truth of the model. I really don't care whether the model is the correct model of the worm. As long as it is able to make some predictions, I'm going to work with this model. What we also need to do, I think, is to focus not on coarse graining models, building a most complex model and then throwing away the details. I mean, it's a separate discussion. Why I think this might not work for biological systems as well as it worked for equilibrium statistical physics. But rather, what we should do is we should work on refining models, where you design the simplest model first, and only if you cannot explain the data with this model, you add additional features, additional linearities, additional hidden variables, and so on and so forth. And we can implement something like this in the context of complete and nested model families, which is what I've shown you here. Such phenomenological models do make predictions which are rather accurate, even if they are outside of the range of on which you train them. And they are interpretable. I mean, I raced through this, but that diagram is really, I can assign biological meaning to every one of the terms in this differential equations. And so, you know, then maybe the last question here is why do something like this, right? It's not really that I believe that this code that we wrote, which you can download and play with, called Sir Isaac on GitHub. It's not that I think that it will derive new theories for us, right? But what it can do is something of the following type. I can try to study, let's say, thermotaxis or pain sensation in a bacterium, in a worm, in a larva, and in something else, right? And building models of these things is very hard. And so I can outsource building models to my code, and it's going to give me out these differential equations, and here they are, and you can compare them. And now my job as a scientist would be to compare them and try to figure out, is there anything similar across a certain domain of systems and a certain domain of questions, so that the models have some shared features. And maybe if you want to respond to temperature pain and you appoint like object, then this is the only way that you can do it, right? If all of them do it in a certain way, right? So the idea is, the analogy is that if you are sort of Robert Hooke in 17th century and you measured force displacement curve for a single spring and it's linear, I mean, it's curiosity, it's not that important. But if you keep on measuring it again and again for all different springs and it always comes out to be linear, then suddenly you have a Hooke's law, right? And so what I'm arguing for is that we can do this automatic inference modeling for many different related systems and try then to look for similarities across systems, not in the behavior, not in the data, but in the models that explain this data. And that's what we're working on now.
Just one, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I always overdo it, right? But
yes. I just want to close the beautiful, actually. So thank you for that talk. I wanted to close the gap a little bit here, and so trying to understand in this sort of different situation that you started to study the C. elegans individuals under ibuprofen or the thermal mutants. If I want to now go back into the dynamical system, do you have a sense or any intuition at which level?
Yeah.
It sounds like the thermal mutant might be involved in the integration part, but I don't know if you are going into that direction or not.
I don't have a definite answer for you right now. I mean, it does take a fair amount of computing time to
right.
do those feats and everything
like
this. But for an ibuprofen mutant, the only thing which seems to be happening that we observe, that seems to be happening right now, is that this thing is, the coefficient is different. So you integrate the temperature signal with a different multiplier. And that's what ibuprofen does, right? So it's a reduction of the perception of the temperature signal. For the mutant, what seems to happen is that this threshold over here is different, which means that the point at which the backward drives gets initiated versus gets stopped, right, is different. But other than that, the actual dynamical system seems to be the same.
Same. Okay.
But again, I'm not 100% sure about this, so this is just preliminary.
Thanks again, and we.